Okay.
Trying to unmute Paul, but he won't. Paul, you'll have to unmute. Oh, there you go. Yep.
Well, I did it. No, right. No, it's still.
No, you're okay.
I'm okay now. Yeah, great. All right. Good. Well, welcome to everyone, particularly to those who are, I think, new to these. And if you're wondering what it's going to be like and what we're going to be doing tonight, well, you're in the same boat as everybody else, because I never tell people in advance exactly what we're going to do. We do a variety of things. And as long as I know roughly what we're going to do, it seems to work. And tonight it's going to be one of those where we focus on a particular book. So last time, I think it was, we delved into a passage, didn't we, in great detail, and we had a good old discussion, yeshiva-type thing, on a particular passage, and we'll do that sort of thing again. And then other times we look at topics. But tonight it's going to be a book. And the way these evenings work is that I'm going to introduce the book for just a few minutes, with some slides that I'll put up shortly. And then comes the reading time. Or the sleeping time, if you prefer, but the idea is that then you all read what it is we're going to then talk about, and then after a suitable amount of time on that, we come back together and start to discuss it and see what sort of questions have come up or answers have come up to the questions that I've got. Okay, so it's a book-based one tonight, and it won't take me too long to say very much before you get into reading it, and about to tell you which one it is, so you can be finding it while I find my screen. We're going to be looking at the short but important book of the prophet Haggai. So, find Haggai. Now, let me apologize in advance in case I mispronounce this, because I think for the vast majority of my life, I used to call him Haggai. And only recently I've actually learned that it's a two-syllable word, and therefore it should be Haggai. But old habits die hard, don't they? So it's quite possible you'll hear me suddenly mentioning Haggai and think, what's he on about now? But it's still Haggai. And we still have that problem, but there we are. So a little bit of background about the book. And first thing I want to tell you is about his name. It's rather an unusual name, and there it is. If you want to learn a little bit of Hebrew at the same time, remember you've gone right to left, so there's the vowels underneath, so that's Haggai, which really does convince me it's only two syllables. Haggai, based upon the verb Hagag, Hagag, which means to gather for a feast, to gather for a feast. Based upon the shorter noun hag, meaning feast. So his name being based upon that, and with the extra bit at the end, there's two possibilities for what his name actually means. The yod at the end could turn it into my feast, but more likely it's an adjective. So we ought to think of him as being festive. So prophet festive or festal. So it's a very, very unusual name. He's the only person in the Bible with that particular name. In fact, he's probably the only person in the world with that particular name, unless you've come across any recently. I don't even think the Stevenson family have got round to a Haggai yet, have they? Whether we will one day. But I've got a feeling there's probably a teddy bear in a bathroom somewhere that's got that name. But it's not that popular. And one survey actually came up with that it was the 9,129th most popular name in the world or something at that time, of which there were just eight people. So unlike quite a few biblical names, where there's lots of them, this one is pretty unique, certainly unique to the Bible. And there's no mention at all, as you start his book, of his family or his father, and that's very unusual because nearly always you have son of somebody, son of someone, because genealogies and roots are important. But there's no mention at all as to his background, his family, his father, we just introduced him straight away as the prophet Haggai. But he clearly came back from exile, and it may be that his family just wasn't very prominent enough to get much of a mention. He might have been, there's a thought that he might have been from a priestly family, but it's not for sure. But a lot of the people that did come back were from priestly families, so it's just a sort of best guess, really. Now, his book, as you already know and can see, is very short, and that's actually because his ministry was very short. He only spoke 5 times in a period of 4 separate days over a period of 3 months. Just to make that clear, there's a 3-month period in which on 4 particular days of that month, he spoke just 5 times. And that's very interesting that it's very short, very sharp, very concentrated, and all the times he spoke are dated. That's how we know it's very clear as you work your way through the book where you are in terms of time. And it was in one particular year, which is the 2nd year of Darius, which is usually regarded as being the year 520 BC. But actually, let's say he only spoke 5 times. There's something like 26, I don't know whether I've counted accurately or someone else has counted, but about 26 sort of thus says the Lord, or the Lord Almighty says, within those 5 times in which he spoke. So there's plenty of very short messages from God, very timely messages, and very sort of pointed messages. So when you're reading it, this is what you'd be looking for, really, is these short, sharp messages. And very unusually as well, the whole book is in prose. Most prophets, their books are in poetry form. But this one is entirely in prose. I don't know why. But although his ministry was short and he only spoke these few times, he did overlap with another significant prophet, just over the page, Zechariah. And by contrast, the name Zechariah is one of the most common in the Bible. I think there's about 29 of them overall. But there's only one prophet, Zechariah, at least with a book. So he overlapped by just 1 month, because Zechariah's prophecies are also dated, and they appear over a 2-year period from 520 to 518. And his book is also in prose, but there's just a 1 month overlap between the two. And Haggai's ministry is also very directed, very pointed, particularly towards two people. He's really speaking from God to the leaders, not to the people. In other words, the two men who led the people back and were in charge of what was happening now they were back. And one of them is Zerubbabel, whose name means the seed of Babylon. And he will have been born in exile. And I think he was about the only survivor now of the royal line of David. I think he was the grandson of the last person that was legitimately king, Jehoiakim. And he was effectively the governor of the remnant that were back. And the other person that he brought messages to would be Joshua, who was the high priest. I say there were plenty of priests that came back. Joshua was the, designated as the high priest. You don't need me to explain his name, I hope. So the background, just in case you want that filled in 538, when the Persian king Cyrus conquered Babylon, he allowed the Jews to return to their land. But only, well, I say a few did. It was about 50,000, I think, but that's relatively a few. For various reasons, not many of them were that bothered or interested in even trying to go back. Most of them by now would have been born in Babylon. So you weren't really going back. They would be going somewhere else. So why would you want to go back if you'd never been there? So they've been born in Babylon. They're established there. They become wealthy there. they got their businesses, their trade, and going back to Jerusalem seemed a very bleak sort of idea, not very good prospects. It would be hard work, a land that hadn't been cultivated for 70 years, a city with no walls. You needed to have real motivation and you needed to have a real pioneering spirit in order to even want to go back. You almost had to have the same pioneering spirit as Abraham had had when he also made a similar journey in the past. They need to be inspired by their father Abraham, who left a place of great sort of prosperity that they had and nice homes and so on to a country they'd never seen. So they were really following in his footsteps a great deal. But when they got back and the job was to build the temple, this was very challenging and even very daunting. Even trying to build a much smaller one than they'd used to before seemed beyond them. And they actually had opposition to the building. The resources soon ran out. The resources that had come back with them from Babylon that Cyrus had allowed them to bring were soon running out. There was opposition from the neighbouring people. So after a couple of years of not getting very far, they stopped. And for 14 more years, they did nothing. So in the end of that long period of time, what have they got to show for it? What have they got to see? Well, maybe just some foundations and a few bits of walls here and there. They become much more concerned with how to eke out a living, how just to survive, never mind about building the temple. So the book will refer to the fact that they were, their food was scarce, the droughts and disease. It was all very depressing, a bit of an anticlimax. They could easily have been asking themselves, why have we bothered? Did we get this right? Was this really the right timing? Have we made the wrong decision? So it's into this situation that Haggai starts to speak. Then comes his messages. And if when you're reading it, you want to, you know, portion it out, just you can find them for yourself, really. But here are the sections within the two chapters, the first 11 verses of chapter 1, then the rest of chapter 1, and then chapter 2, 1 to 9, 10 to 19, 20 to 23. But you can tell because they're all dated. Someone has obviously worked out that these dates refer to August, September time in our calendar, but it gives you some idea of how they're spaced out. And you'll notice that the last two times he spoke were on the same day. And then that was it. So you can see how they're spaced out all around that sort of, well, for us, an autumnal sort of time. So that'll give you some kind of framework if you want to read that. But as well as reading the two chapters of Haggai, I wonder if it's worth, in the time I'm going to give you, reading one or two other bits. So did you realise, oops, I've gone too far. Did you realise that Haggai and Zechariah are mentioned elsewhere, in particular in Ezra, because Ezra, of course, tells the same sort of story. So they get an actual mention in chapters 5 and 6. So if in the reading time you want to look back over those first six chapters of Ezra just to get a bit more of an understanding of what the situation was like, then you will have time to do that. You can skip through bits, really. Certainly I'd recommend you skip chapter 2. I think it's just a list of names. So Ezra 5 and 6, or early on from chapter 1 to 6. And then Zerubbabel, if you want a bit more on him, he's mentioned in the Bible. He's actually in the lineage of Jesus, but in particular he's mentioned in Zechariah chapter 4, actually from verse 6 onwards. But you could supplement again your Haggai reading with a chapter from Zechariah. In fact, I'd recommend at some point you sit down and read the whole of the book of Zechariah, if you haven't done so recently. So in terms of then when we come back to discuss what you've read, well, I'm going to give you some sort of pointers now, some questions perhaps. And one thing is to look at how God actually motivated them. What How did what he say actually make a difference, if it did make a difference? Was it a carrot or a stick or both? And in particular, look at the number of times when God speaks, he uses questions. And I think he's trying to remind them of certain things. There's one phrase which occurs four times, or at least slightly differently worded, but four times you get something gone wrong. Give careful thought to your ways. You'll find that cropping up at key moments. And again, the question is, you know, why was that necessary for them to give careful thought to their ways at this point? And are there any other key words? And then just a few more questions to occupy your thinking. Wonder why after just, after 3 months, that was it. Why do you think Haggai's prophecies ended when they did? Why was his ministry soon over? And if it had been you, would you have been a bit miffed? Why only 3 months? Why have I got to stop now? What have I done wrong, God? Do you think he was upset, disappointed, maybe even a little jealous that Zechariah had come along and taken over? I suppose it all depends whether he feels that God was giving him more to say. Actually, now I think about it, I'm not too sure when he died, so that might have come into it, but I haven't got any dates as such. But then we really want to go on to answer some of these, or discuss some of these. What do you think God is saying to us today through this book? Whether it's for you individually, personally, whether there's a bigger message nationally, internationally. Is God saying anything to us at this particular moment, to believers and to the church? So there's lots of different ways that the discussion time can go. And given that it's now about 25 past seven, we'll see where we've got to in 20 minutes. So we've got plenty of discussion time. So till about 7:45 then, when I will come back, and at this point we will pause the recording perhaps. Oh, can I start by clearing up any confusion I made earlier, because we've got two Stevens with us who have both written on Haggai, and Stephen Bishop, who I think has joined us for the first time. I didn't know he was joining us tonight. He didn't know we were doing Haggai. So thank you, Lord, for coordinating all this, because he can now answer all the questions or bring in... No, he's shaking his head. All right. But Stephen, if you want to just show again the booklet that you wrote a little while back, if people are going to speak of you, if you unmute yourself, Stephen, and just say something, and then can you unmute yourself? And then if people want to go on to speak of you, and just explain the book you wrote.
Well, this is a book that was prepared for CWR in their cover to cover guide series, so it's not in depth, but it's supposed to be aimed at being a very practical application or explanation and application of whatever passage or part of the Bible is being considered. So I volunteered some material on this, and this is the result. And as you can see, motivating God's people was the subtitle, which obviously links in with what Paul's already explained as to the main raison d'etre of the book, as well.
Prophecies. And your book is in sort of seven short sections for group discussion.
That's correct. Yeah.
So you can do further study on it and further discussion on it. Thank you. So, that was a spotlight video. Should we leave? Did someone do that?
I'm trying to.
You're trying to, okay.
I've got you on spotlight.
You now. But the other Steve, who's writing books all the time, has also been writing, including on this. Oh, he's coming up full screen as well now.
I've just had a haircut.
So Steve will also know that, make some comments in due course. Are we trying to cancel this spotlighting thing, or are you, Christina, are you wanting it to stay?
I've got speak of you, I'm not sure.
If people put gallery view, that's
your... it's the same. Right, okay, just go back to gallery view if you want to see others and so on. Right, well, there's no particular order in which we do these. For some of you in particular, you'll have studied the book in detail before. Others might have not read it very much. So there'll be a whole variety of different perspectives on it. But who would like to start with an usual sort of raise hand thing, please, and Christine will try and find you. Either with a comment, an answer to a question, or a new question, it doesn't matter where we go from here. This is now finding out.
If you could find the button to raise your hand, because I've got two screens, and if you're on the screen I'm not looking at, I won't find you if you just wave. But I will try and keep an eye on both.
Yeah. I mean, you can just unmute yourself and start speaking and hope that nobody else says something at the same time. I don't mind that.
Oh, yeah.
Do we have anybody? Or are we...
What's going on?
Well, we can all go home now.
We're going to have a bit of silence on it now.
Yep.
Well, I'll tell a story while we're waiting, if I must. Have you heard the story of the three people building a wall?
Hello. Sorry, I joined late, and I know we're reading Haggai, but that's all I know.
Yeah, and now we're going to discuss it, really.
We have got a hand up. We have.
Yeah, we have. Good.
Would you unmute yourself, Marion? Sorry.
Unmute
yourself, Marion.
Very short. I just thought that he only had a very short ministry, and the people responded. That was why he didn't need to go on.
Yeah. Okay. Job done. And there was Zechariah who had picked this up and was going to say a lot more. So, yeah, probably a good message for many of us that feel that we're indispensable and God needs to use us repeatedly. And sometimes he might just say, that's it, you've done your bit for me. But do we have another hand up then? Was Kit? Kit, were you coming in somewhere? Yes, Kit's raised his hand.
Yeah, I was... Consider Your Ways really struck me, as you mentioned earlier, but I mean, it does really come up. And of course, that's something to apply personally, because sometimes God has to say that quite a few times before you really do consider your ways.
Mm.
But then I actually went into the Hebrew, and I'm really hoping for some wisdom from you, because the word for consider is kind of put, make. I couldn't quite work out why it meant consider. I thought I was going to get some depth of insight into it, but actually I've just got confused.
Okay. I'll see what I can dig around in the next few minutes while we're all talking about it.
Okay.
I mean, the translation we tend to get is give careful thought, which is what considering is, but it really means stop and think, doesn't it? I mean, not just have a quick think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we might be able to follow up the Hebrew a bit. But you're right, it's a very significant thing that is said four times, twice exactly like that and twice otherwise. If people didn't find it, it's in chapter 1, verses 5 and 7, and then chapter 2, verses 15 and 18.
In the new One New Man, it says, give careful thought.
Right. Okay. I was telling you about someone else, Michael Oakley.
It was just the thought, Paul, that God has got the hump with them, because what they've been doing, he knows only too well. Their heart's not in it. Mm. And considering the fact that he asks for the first fruits of their labours, he asks for the best. He asks for the very first amount of time that we give. And he knows full well that when it comes to lip service, we can do as much as we want, but as far as he's concerned, it's pointless and achieves absolutely nothing.
I mean, it's worth asking the question, sorry, Beth, we'll come to you in a minute, but have we ever started something for God, lost heart, lost motivation, felt it wasn't worth it, and then either sort of regretted that or found that God has kicked us up the backside and said, really, I want you to do this. So we might find some personal examples where we start off with a great amount of enthusiasm, I'm going to do this and do it for God, and then 2 years later or whatever, we're back to just self-serving and looking after our own things. If you've got any thoughts on that, let us know. Betty, though, had a hand up, I think.
Can you unmute yourself, Betty?
Okay. Yeah, you've really touched on it, Paul, with what you were saying, because I find that I get demotivated because what I feel that I'm doing is not up to scratch. It's not as perfect as it ought to be if it's for the Lord. And we can sort of set some very high, our own sort of mind gets in the way, thinking what we think ought the outcome ought to be rather than what God has decided to do. Another thing that struck me was that people can't catch goodness, but they can catch sin.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes I justify not doing anything because I think if I lead a good life and if I treat people properly, they'll know it's because I'm a Christian. So they will. But from this, I picked up, no, they can't catch it. You have to do something. You have to tell them or do something. I don't know whether that's right, but
well, this is the bit from chapter 2 and verse 10 onwards, isn't it?
Yes.
If people want to double check on that. It's interesting why he suddenly brings that in, or why God suddenly brings that in. This is particularly speak to the priests. Mm. As I say, a lot of what Haggai had to say was specifically to leaders, either Zerubbabel, Joshua, or the priests, and so on. So, do you have any other hand up at the moment? I can't see one. I'll come back to my story then about the three people building a wall. And someone went up to the first one and said, what are you doing? He said, I'm building a wall. And he went to the second one and said, what are you doing? He said, I'm building a cathedral. Uh-huh. The third one, he said, what are you building? I'm building for the glory of God. So the more you get the bigger picture of it and the more insight into what you're actually doing, then the more likely to keep going, I imagine. Anyway.
We have a question now.
We do.
Jackie. You can unmute yourself.
It's not a question, it's more the second sort of section, 1:12-15, when the people start to obey. It just reminded me of the other scripture, which I've just quickly searched for, 1 Samuel 15:22, where it says, obedience is better than sacrifice. And I just feel it's good to be reminded of things like that when, you know, if we are, yeah, depending on what we're doing, what is, you know, it's like, what's the highest form of worship? Well, actually studying God's word. What's the highest form of giving God what you've got? Well, obedience. Mm. I don't want to make it too simplistic, but it just was a good reminder.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was in the last bit of chapter one, was it? She's gone, I think. Did anyone spot the shortest of all the messages that God said? It's in verse 13 of chapter 1. It said God spoke about 26 times in these different messages, and in chapter 1 and verse 13, all he says is four words. In fact, in Hebrew, it's probably two now I think about it. But all God had to say at that point is, I am with you.
The word of the Lord following on from that.
Yeah. And sometimes that's just all we need to really know and to hear God saying, I am with you, which of course is what Jesus said, his promise, and the Holy Emmanuel thing, isn't it? If God is with us and we know he's with us, we will get on with it.
Paul, I noticed that in chapter 2, and verse 5, God says, this is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt.
Yeah.
And my spirit remains among you. Do not fear. And I thought, what did they have to fear at that time? And also that he's also reminding them of, you know, I said to Steve just now, how many generations had passed by since they came out of Egypt?
Oh, yeah. Well, I haven't got a number, but you're right. It's one of those questions where you just say loads, yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, it was something they would always remember. because it was a major covenant, and also because by celebrating Passover, which they may or may not be doing at this point very much, then this was how they would remember that. And one of the great motivations is always to look back and think what God did in the past. And what God did in the past was mighty and wonderful, and it's not going to just fizzle out now. So build on that. Keep going because of what God has done in the past. I suppose the do not fear might refer to the fact that they had opposition from people nearby. Did anyone get into Ezra and remind themselves about that? That they had opposition? Or they might just have been frightened, like someone was saying, that I'm not going to do this well enough. I can't do this properly. You know, you look at what little you've done and you think, nah. So they might have been frightened internally as well as frightened by situations externally.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Kit has his hand up.
I was just thinking about do not fear. Also what you said about 1:13, I am with you, says the Lord, that shortest command. And just before that, it says the people feared the presence of the Lord. They were stirred up to fear the Lord. So his response was, it's okay, I'm with you. And then maybe that was the fear rather than externally. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that is part of it, because one of the things I put down here is that it seemed as though they did need to have a fear of the Lord put back into them through these messages. Oh, God is actually, he's watching, he's checking up on us. You know, we thought we could just stop here and sit back for a while. But, oh, no, God is really, you know, he's brought us back for a reason and he's not pleased because we've stopped. But as well as fear, that's what I said about carrot and stick. You need that side of it. But at the same time, they need to be inspired, reminded, encouraged. And the leaders had to have the passion to bring the other people with them, really. So I see two things happening here. You're right. Fear of the Lord is necessary for the people to fear, but the leaders have got to be instilled with a lot of passion to get people going again.
Yeah. Michael Oakley.
It was just an answer to Monica. I calculate 925 years. Egypt, it is 40 years a generation, 23 generations, Monica. Just thought you'd like to know.
Yeah, you say lots, thanks.
Okay, and Jackie? You need to unmute.
Yeah, I was struck with the phrase, the Lord of Hosts. I had a look at some of the names of God at one point, but I think this is like Jehovah Sabaoth. Sabaoth, I think it is. And the first time that's mentioned, so I think there was something about a reverence and an awesome fear, but the first time that's mentioned is in 1 Samuel 17:45, when David says to Goliath, you come against me with sword and spear, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of the host of heaven's armies, or the Lord of hosts, Jehovah Sabaoth. And I just think it's God kind of saying, I'm God of gods, I'm Lord of lords, you know, get a grip, people here. Yeah, I'm not just any God.
Yeah, we've got we've got Lord Almighty all the way through our translations. You've got Lord of Hosts, have you? Is that what you're saying? Was that a particular verse you were commenting on, or just generally all the way through?
I have got it a number of times through.
Yeah.
So like right from the very beginning, chapter 1 and verse 2, this is what the Lord Almighty says.
Well, I need to find it again now.
I did some research into that, Paul, and in terms of Haggai and the number of instances of the word Lord being used, or the Lord says, and also the Lord Almighty, in terms of the size of the book, it has the more mentions of God than any other book of the Bible.
Oh, yeah.
If you take the proportion of the size of the book,
and
in terms of the Lord Almighty, of what Jackie was saying, there's only one book that uses it more. I think that Zechariah or something, but it just shows you how much the Lord is a part of this very very small book.
I hadn't noticed, just glancing through now, that every time it is declares the Lord, it is the Lord Almighty.
Yeah.
Well, except for once, I've just found Lord, but most of the time. Lord Almighty. That's probably a phrase or a thought we don't employ enough in our own thinking about God, just what that means, his might. In fact, did any of you come on to read Zechariah 4? Did you get to that bit?
Yeah.
Because that's where the famous verse is to Zerubbabel, isn't it, that everybody quotes, and most people don't know they're quoting Zechariah. But not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. In other words, that's how this job is going to be completed, by understanding that it's through the Spirit of God. And I sort of understand not by might, not by power means not by the by one man's immense strength, power, charisma, whatever, nor by a mighty army, not by a whole group. So it's not going to happen by one single human or a whole load of humans, but it's going to be by God. So it's the Lord Almighty that's going to complete the job if they will cooperate and agree with him. So, Maureen. There's the raised hand, Maureen. Somewhere.
Unmute yourself, Maureen. We can't, there you go.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I'd like to follow on from that, actually. In chapter 1, verse 14, it says that the Lord stirred up the Spirit.
Oh, yeah.
And it says, and the Spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts.
Yeah.
So the Spirit brought them all together. And yeah, that seems to follow on to me from what you just said.
Yeah. And it just follows on from that, I am with you, seemed to be enough. And then the Lord stirred them up. And that follows on from the people fearing the Lord in the first place. So,
and bringing everyone to that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone felt the same. Yeah. But that's what my book seems.
Well, exactly. And that's what would be needed, really, because it's no good just a few people getting enthusiastic again, because the others would soon drag them down. Yeah. It's got to motivate everybody at the same time. Yeah.
And the signet as well, in 23. He'll make them a signet. Zerubbabel.
Zerubbabel, yes. Take a run at it. Zerubbabel.
Yes. And Sheila.
Well, that's a fascinating way, because it ends there, you see, basically, doesn't it? That's the last thing he says. What do we make of this, I will make you like my signet ring? What does that speak to you of? Do you think it's a powerful message that's been given there?
It's significant. It's very significant, because that is, yeah, a gift. To make them one. Is it to make them one? I don't know.
Anyone else want to comment upon the signet ring?
It's a thing of authority.
Authority, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Stephen Bishop was waving his hand just now. Go for it, Stephen.
Yeah, authority, but also security.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was reassurance to Zerubbabel that he was not going to be left on his own, but that God was with him, but God had endued him with authority and a sense of security in what was going to go ahead.
Yeah. Do you remember who else was given a signet ring earlier in the Old Testament? Anyone remember?
David gave it to
him. It was someone who has become number two in the land.
It was Joseph.
Yeah, given by Pharaoh. When he appointed him as number two, he says he gave him his signet ring, so basically giving him the authority to do that job. So,
okay, Jeremy his hand up, and then Mary.
The seed of Babylon, I think you said his name meant,
which
is an extremely unlikely meaning.
Yeah, well, Babel being, you know, the Babel, Babylon bit, and I can sort of vaguely remember Zerub. I think that's one of the books of the Mishnah, it's called the Zerub, because it's to do with seeds, and I think it's all the laws about agriculture or something. So when I saw it like that, I suddenly thought, oh yeah, it does make sense, Zerubbabel. But it's not a great name to have, unless it just seems, you know, you were born there and brought up there, so.
Well, the Lord can exalt him, he wills, I guess.
Exactly, yes. Sometimes he picks the least likely people. But I say he was the one who had the only one left probably, who had some kind of royal lineage. Michael,
Mary.
Well, okay, Michael put your hand up a moment ago and it's gone down again. So put it up again if you want to join in, Michael. But we've got Mary as well, have we?
Yeah.
Let's have Mary first then.
Yeah, okay. I was just thinking of the signet ring. You know, when anyone wrote a letter and they used the wax, they put their signet ring on the wax.
Yeah.
To prove that, and that it was from that particular source.
Yeah. True. Michael then?
It was just a comment about Joseph, the fact that he had been rejected by all his brothers, and yet God chose to raise him to the point where Pharaoh effectively gave him the day-to-day power in the land, because he too could seal documents with the authority of Pharaoh.
Yeah.
So it's a position of ultimate power, from above. So it was just a question of giving it that significance.
And what's interesting here is that Zerubbabel isn't getting it from someone else, but he's getting it from God. In other words, I will take you and I will make you like my signet ring, for I have chosen you. That's another important little phrase we need to motivate us and encourage us, not just for I'm with you, but I have chosen you. I'm not going back over the whole predestination thing that we've looked at before, but just the times we need to hear that particular aspect of it, that God has chosen us for this job. It keeps me going, because sometimes I feel, oh, do I really want to keep going? Do I really want to do this and another one of these and all the rest of it? But if God says, I have chosen you, and you know that's what I want you to do, then you keep going. Was it Jackie again?
Yes.
Things just keep coming to me as I keep looking. Chapter 2, I think it's verse 9, is the last bit of that section. The glory of the latter house will be greater than that of the former, and I shall give peace in this place. And there's a note in the One New Man Bible that says, the glory of the second temple never exceeded that of the first. So this is prophetic concerning the third temple. Does anyone want to comment on that? Because I just thought it was an interesting point, but is it true?
Yeah, you're right about this. This is what, this is the bit of the book that causes the Jews most problems, because they say this never happened. As you rightly said, this temple was never greater than the glory of the former, and the desire of all nations didn't come, and so on. So they're very tempted to say at this point, well, Haggai got it wrong, or, you know, he's a false prophet, and so on. But, of course, we know that it's even more prophetic. But in terms of the glory of this house, well, did the glory of God ever go there? Yes, because Jesus went there, when, you know, talking about the ventral extended Herod's temple and so on. But although it's prophetic of still more to come, that they Jews who don't actually believe in Jesus don't see that this particular verse or two has been fulfilled, because they, as you rightly say, the note says that the glory didn't exceed the glory of the former house, but so there must have been more to come. So has that helped explain what you were just saying? Two more. Who is it? Pat?
Yes, Pat. Oh, you are unmuted. We can't hear you, Pat. No, we still can't hear you. We've got a buzz.
But holding your line, I think. We'll come back to you if we can get you. Who else is there? Someone else. Another hand somewhere.
Betty.
Right.
It's a question, really, Paul. When we get to verse 21, I mean, is that a forecast of the end times and Jesus coming back? And does that tie up? Was Zerubbabel an ancestor of Jesus? I mean, he's a line of David. Was he an ancestor of Jesus?
That's right. He's in the lineage in Matthew chapter 1, Well, there's also the shaking, of course, that occurs earlier in the chapter, when from verse 6 onwards. It's probably one of those things again where we think there is another shaking to come, and perhaps we're already in it now to some extent, because it hasn't all happened exactly like that. When it says eventually I will, you often get these sort of double fulfillments. You get something happening at the time which seems to fulfill to some extent, but we can certainly see there's more to come. But I will overturn royal thrones and shatter the power of the foreign kingdoms. That is going to take the return of Jesus to complete that for sure. So at this point, he starts to get a little more, you might say, deeply prophetic, which of course is what happened to Zechariah as well. In his much longer book, you've got about 8 chapters in which he's very much speaking to his own time. And then he has 2 big oracles at the end, which clearly don't fit anything that's happened yet and are still to come. So, yeah, I think in Haggai you get these little glimpses, extra sort of snippets of that still to come, particularly in referring to all the shaking and the result of that. I mean, if he says in a little while I will once more shake, you could say, well, he said that several times and there's been lots of shakings and there's still more to come, including a big one. So, yeah.
We've got Pat, then Mary.
Pat again, can we hear you this time?
No, we can't hear you, Pat. There's something wrong with the sound, your end.
Can you hear me?
Oh.
Yes, that's better.
Okay, thanks. It was just Jackie's comment about the former glory and the latter glory. And do you think it could be applying to Jesus in the sense of him being the second Adam as opposed to the first Adam?
To some extent, there's something about that in there, yes. Yes. But then, even, yeah, there is another glory to come. But the Shekinah glory never actually came to that temple they were building, I don't think. So, except in the person of Jesus, of course.
Okay, we have Mary.
I've got a wee reference, Hebrews 12:26, which refers back to Haggai.
All right.
Let me see it. Yet once more I shake not only the earth but also heaven. Previously, see that you do not refuse him who speaks, but if they did not escape who refused him who spoke on earth, much more shall we not escape if we turn away from him who speaks from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth. But now he has promised, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth, but also heaven. So it's a kind of reference to Haggai.
It is, isn't it? Yes. Michael again, Michael Oakley.
Yeah, sorry, I've come back on it, but verse 23, am I not right in thinking that having cut the line of succession from Jeconiah, it's restored through Zerubbabel?
Okay.
When he actually appoints him in verse 23.
That's an interesting point, yes. So do you want to explain what you mean by having cut the line?
The story of Jehoiakim or Jeconiah, his poor, he was asked to take a message from God to the king who at the time would have had authority to have the signet. And his scribe, I think it was, or his amanuensis, wrote out all this message, and Jeconiah did no more than tear it up and throw it in the fire. And so God says, right, do it again, go write it all out again and take it. And the same thing happened. The scrolls ended up in the fire. Now this is God's word, and for that God says, count this man as childless. And it's a, when I'm asked at Christmas time, how do you know Joseph isn't the father of Jesus? So I always quote that verse.
Yeah. because Jack and I comes into the genealogy in Matthew as well, doesn't he?
He's in the line.
Yeah.
But if he's childless and God does not go back, if he says something,
yeah,
he means it.
Yeah. And of course, Jack and I was not in the line of Mary. She went back to David through a different route. So Jesus could be physically born of Mary in David's line. But I like the idea, yes, you say that sort of Zerubbabel then becomes the sort of pickup of the fact that God is stopping the line because of Jeconiah, but he still wants someone in that line, and was Joseph, to have a role, even if not an exact father's role, but to have some role in bringing Messiah into the world. Yeah?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting connection, yeah. If anyone's not totally familiar with what we've just been saying, you need to go back and read, I suppose it's the end, is it the end of Kings or the end of Chronicles, somewhere where God declares about this guy who's got various names. He's Jehoiakim and he's Jeconiah and therefore Kaniah as well. But God says, record this man as childless, as though he had as no children. He did have children, but God is saying they're not going to count anymore in the royal line. So thanks for bringing that in. Do we have any more hands at this point?
Not at the moment.
Jeremy.
Well, thank you. Yes, you were asking about how these passages or this passage in Haggai particularly spoke about today.
Mm.
And I thought that was a really interesting question. And of course, we've got this part, haven't we, about everything being shaken, which comes to mind straight away. And also in Haggai 2, verse 14, that there's a point in which God is saying, look, whatever they do and whatever they offer is defiled. And I wondered if there is a sense that whatever we're doing as church, or have been doing before we were interrupted, has not actually been coming up to scratch. And I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that is a very good point, yes. Anyone else want to come in on that? Steve?
I thought you might. thank you, Jeremy, because I've been sitting here waiting for people to look at sort of modern day applications to the story in Haggai, because that's how the Lord spoke to me. I'm not, I tend not to operate in that way in terms of my writings, but this time Haggai really shouted at me in terms of what's happening with lockdown and in terms of what Jeremy has just been saying. It's the case of, you know, the exile, the Babylonian exile was basically, God declaring, the exile as a result of the idolatry of the people, and also the priests and the, people involved in the temple getting very corrupt. So, and then you look at the parallel, as I see now in lockdown, in what's happened to us, in that the church has been halted in its stride. And one aspect of it is the fact that the church isn't, or the local church in general, isn't doing what it was meant to do at the beginning. It deviated away from the norm. It's allowed impurities to come in, and Greek systems, etc. And we've been given another chance, just like in the days of Haggai. They had a chance to get back and rebuild the temple. And the way I saw it is that us, or the remnant, or just Christians in general, this is our call to rebuild the temple, to get back to the purity of the faith, and to try to learn the lesson of what has gone wrong with the local church. The warnings were earlier in Haggai 1 about all the things you put your hands to, haven't you noticed it's never quite worked for you? I've held things back from you because you haven't been doing what I asked you to do, and I see that in the local church, apart from the obvious examples of good things happening. But in general, why our local church doesn't do the business the way it's evolved into where it is now. And God's given us another chance through lockdown, through the virtual medium, something like this, with people from, we've never had so many people coming to our Bible studies compared to before lockdown. And people are waking up to the fact that sometimes there can be a combination of of what we're doing on the virtual side to what people do when they meet together in their local church. So, you know, this could be a real pivotal moment. And for me, it was just Haggai. And I just sort of, every time I read through it, it just spoke to me about the situation. So afterwards, I know we haven't got time now, but, you know, when you go turn off and get back to Haggai, read it again, reread it, but think about modern day applications. Think about if God is calling out his church in the same way as he called out the Hebrews at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, etc. See where the parallel is, and you know, the shaking of the nations. You know, the nations have never been shaken as they have just in the last 3 months. You know, I cannot find a time in history, recent history, where virtually every one of our institutions have taken a hit, and the effects of that hasn't even happened yet. You know, you wait till, you know, the recession comes and you know, everything, every part of our culture is having to change. We've been shaped from top to bottom. But it's the church, the shaking of the church, that we should be mostly looking at. And what do we learn? Have we learned from it? Or are our pastors just seeing this as a blip and they'll get back, you know, normal business as soon as we leave lockdown? Let's forget about Zoom and all these, you know, irrelevancies and get back to doing what we did before. And I think that's when God will continue to shake the nations, I believe. And you know, everything is about God's people at the end of the day. And if God's people are not listening, then, you know, there's trouble ahead. So, you know, speech over.
Anyone else want to come in on that? Comment on what you just said, or extra thoughts of your own, or...
That's
Betty again. Yeah.
Yes. Can you unmute yourself?
Yes, thanks, Steve. I mean, I've been sitting here thinking, I have Zoom meetings with the fellowship that I belong to now, but they're nothing like this. And they just want to get back to how it was before. And it's like a light bulb's gone off in my brain now that maybe that's what the Lord is saying to us, that I don't know how, but somehow we need to, because our church is lovely, but you know, it's just, it's not what this is. And I yearn to be able to have discussions like this and to thrash things out and be prepared to differ if necessary and sort of speak to each other. So maybe the Lord is saying, okay, you do it. So maybe I'll send out a mass invitation for everybody for next week. Our fellowship's only 20-odd people. It's less than the number here now. That's so right. Who knows?
But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think new things are going to emerge as part of this. We had our church AGM on Zoom last night, which was fascinating because, again, the leader was trying to explain what's happening. And I was really glad that he was saying that... we're going to continue to do Zoom-based things, even if we can get back eventually into buildings. And there's going to be sort of mixture, I think, will happen, sort of hopefully keeping some of the better things that have happened in the past. But we're not going to just ditch it all. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it works out in my own church. Some churches won't go with it. Others will create a new sort of hybrid model. And other groups will go on in this fashion anyway, because we'll be supplementing what can be done. Monica?
Have I unmuted myself? Yeah.
Yep.
The verse is actually that I'm trying to sort of analyse and work out are chapter 1 verses 5 and 6. Now, this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You have planted much, but have harvested little. You eat, but never have enough. You drink, but never have your fill. And you put on clothes, but are not warm. I can get the bit about wages and stuff like that. But the other things, the food, the drink, the clothing, they keep eating, they keep doing the same thing, but they're not satisfied. And I'm just wondering what the equivalent is in our churches. Are we con- do we concentrate too much on one thing, but we're sowing something, but when we're not reaping the harvest, what are those things that we do too much of, but we're not satisfied, we're not getting satisfaction and a harvest from them?
Our experience of local church, not giving any names, but in all the years we've been in the local church environment, we've hardly seen any conversions, any new believers coming through the activities of that church. We've had Christians from other churches coming in, and yet the whole point of what we're doing, you know, the Great Commission is the whole point of everything, and surely everything should be according to that yardstick. Of are we fulfilling the Great Commission? And just from my experience, and obviously you all have different experiences, is that the Great Commission doesn't seem to work with the local church model that I've had experience of. And for me, that sort of answers that question, in that is what we're meant to be doing. But we might be sowing a few seeds and we're nice to people and we're showing a good face, but in terms of discipling people, you know, it doesn't seem to happen for me. Obviously, all of you will have different, experiences, but that's just my observation on that. Michael wants to say something.
Yes. This, Steve. You may be interested to know that I go to a church where you are not allowed to speak unless you are licensed. Honestly, Paul, you are not allowed to speak unless you are licensed. And yet, because of the fact that now the church meets through Zoom, the rector has said, if anyone's got a thought for the day or a 20-minute sermon, please send it in. So it seems, unless the Church of England are going to sack him and take away his large mansion he's in, if only, all of a sudden, we have this opportunity. And I take the point that how can we grow when we don't follow Jesus' model? I mean, the disciples, would hear Jesus tell a parable. And I may be wrong, but 2/3 to 3/4 of the crowd hadn't got a clue what he's on about. The disciples get back and say, well, what was that about? And he said, well, if you're prepared... and it was true of the quarter that were listening, if you're prepared to think about it, you will find the message. And it's, I see, quite frankly, the local church house groups that have replaced formal church at the moment, nothing more than Facebook. And it saddens me, because I think there needs to be that stimulus. But I'll shut up now, because I need to be muted for the rest of the evening.
Okay.
Can I share something? Going back to what Betty was saying, it rather struck me that a lot of the people who want to get back together are actually wanting to get back together because they want the social interaction. They want the cups of tea afterwards and everything like that. And they're not the ones that want to be back to pray together, to hear the word of God. They want to be singing together because we can't sing at home and all of this kind of thing. So it's more of a, they want social interaction, not the glory of the Lord kind of thing.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, going back to the book of Haggai, one of the key words in there is glory. It's all about God's glory in the end. And that's what they had to build. I remember I said earlier about the three builders. Come back to my little story. Are you building a wall? Are you building a cathedral? Or are you building for the glory of God? Because that ultimately what matters. And then the building will take care of itself, in other words. So you can have so many different perspectives. Some people go to church just for the wall or the building, not the glory of God. Anybody else want to come in on particularly recent comments, sticking perhaps now to... Yeah, Marion?
Okay. Now, this is weird, because we were actually stopped from doing something which you'll probably think is is completely counterproductive to stop it. We were actually going out on the street, stopping our services once a month on a Sunday and going out on the street on a Saturday, having Saturday church out on the street, talking to people. Now, that was good, but behind that was this worry that we were just doing something that the NAR are sort of promoting, the apostolic thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I was almost saying, no, I don't want to do it, because we were sort of half linked to that. But really, what we were doing, and hopefully we will carry on doing, is going out on the street and talking to people, is the right thing. I'm completely confused now.
No, that's fine. I think we got the point that, the church needs to be out there rather than inside, so to speak. So do we have anybody else at this point? Pat, you put your hand up. Unmute yourself, please. I'm sure that phrase is going into the next edition of the dictionary. Will you unmute yourself, please?
All right. I hadn't got my hand up, but I was just actually thinking about what you were speaking about.
Oh, sorry. It was the other Pat, actually. It was Pat.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'll cope with this.
Pat. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think it was me. Yeah, it's just, I totally agreed with what Monica was saying, in fact, and I made a note about verse 6, the same thing, because I just feel that it did speak to me very much about church and where we're at, because actually the Lord blesses us so much in our lives and in our congregations and all the rest of it. And it says here about, you know, you have this, but you don't have enough. And as Monica was just saying from this scripture, and I think there's a tendency, and somebody else has touched on it as well, about people are missing the fellowship, and there's nothing wrong with those things, but we're just really somewhere along the line, and I feel it quite strongly, is that we've just missed what it's all about, like, you know, reaching the unsaved and getting out there. We've made it very cozy for ourselves, and bless ourselves, this is an expression I use quite, we bless ourselves richly with our shared teas and all this and that and the other, and there's nothing wrong with any of those things. It's just that they've actually seemed to have taken over, that the balance has got all wrong, and that we should be serving the Lord, and not making things very comfortable and cozy for ourselves behind these walls, that people just don't get what's happening behind that wall. So that those verses spoke to me a lot.
Those verses in chapter 1, verses 6, but it is just verse 6, it's a long verse, isn't it? Basically, it reads to me like God has stopped the economy, because that's what did happen to them. For some reason, they didn't get the harvest because of drought or something like that. Their money wasn't worth as much. This is an economic shutdown that they were experiencing, so that they could then give careful thought to their ways. Stephen, Bishop.
Yeah, can I bring a kind of wider perspective to those opening verses, in terms that God was speaking to the Jewish people as a whole, and if we are trying to, one way we could apply it to our own situation is that God is shaking not so much individual churches, but kind of the national church, for want of a better expression. And in one sense, the situation as it is at the moment is that churches as a whole, big organisations, the Anglican Church denominations, are going to be suffering, if not already, considerably in a financial sense. And also, the Church of England often reports on lack of clergy. So kind of these two combinations, and others possibly, are going to provide a shaking, not so much for us individually to start with, but the whole structure. Yes. And it's going to be as a result of the whole structure shaking that we in our local churches will be kind of caught into that, but also have the opportunity to see God build up through it. So it was a kind of perspective which may be applicable along with the other ones that we've been discussing.
I think it's a very good point, yes. I mean, my church doesn't have a building, we hire a school, so we're sort of saving money at the moment because we're not having to hire the school that we normally go into, but there are other costs still, and of course people without their jobs at the moment aren't able to give us much, so the financial impact will hit all the different churches in different ways, but certainly those that are built on hierarchical structures. Is it Maureen next? Unmute, please. Unmute, please.
Thank you. Hello. I'm also going on to chapter 1 and verse 8, where it says to go up a mountain and bring the word
to
the house, and I will take pleasure in it. And this week, I've been reading parts of the Bible. I can't remember exactly where they were, but what I read was that Jesus went up the mountain and spoke and prayed with the Lord, and he met with Moses and Abraham. And Moses went up into the mountain and brought the Ten Commandments down. What I read was, when you go up the mountain and you spiritually speak with the Lord, you pray, it's the Spirit of the Lord that you come down with. You build the house, you build wood, and you build it, and that's what I felt. I might be wrong, but that's what I felt, that the Lord glory with you.
Yeah, no, I like that point.
The Spirit.
We go up the mountains to get stuff from God and bring it back down to build up the house of God, people of God. So, yeah, going up the mountain, it's not just like Moses getting the law, the commandments, and his face shining and all the rest of it. But I always think about Jesus going up on a mountain to teach, and the disciples had to go up to him. Same as we were saying earlier about when Jesus taught the crowds, half of them just couldn't be interested and bothered very much. The disciples are the ones that had to go up the mountain, because then they would get more from him in order to then build it on their lives and into the kingdom. So we are called to go up mountains to spend time with God in order to bring things back down to help build the house of God. Thank you.
That's a spiritual going up the mountain.
Yes, well, it is. It's a way of going to where God is. It's going into his presence more. And I think people are finding that in this time on their own, they at least got the opportunity to go more into God's presence themselves.
Yes.
And they will grow and learn things that they wouldn't do, because otherwise they just thought, oh, I'll just go to church and I'll get it that way. They're now discovering it doesn't work that way.
Oh, I just thought that was interesting, that I should read that this week. And then,
yeah, this is the great thing about just pausing to read part of the Bible, is that it will connect with different people in different ways. So, going back to Pat Baird, did you really want to say something when do you want to come back in again or not?
No, it's fine.
Okay, thank you. Didn't want to cut you off. Anybody else? We are slightly overrunning, which is great. Steve, do you want to add anything more yourselves?
No.
Steve Maltz, do you want to come in? Okay.
Christine Wright has
her hand up. A hand up, and then we might draw it to an end.
Can you unmute yourself, Christine?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I think that for me, I'm just for myself and all the Christians I'm meeting, I think that a lot of us are just exhausted from all the problems in the world.
Mm.
And what Steve said was very true. I mean, I don't think that we have actually, I mean, all the evangelization efforts that I'm seeing, it seems like the soil is very hard. I mean, people's hearts are very hard. I mean, they're not receptive to the gospel. And I don't see anybody coming to faith, like, very much. I don't see many people coming to faith in any churches or in any ministries. So I don't know what's happening. I mean, a lot of Christians are just worn down.
Mm-hmm. And well, like they were in Haggai's day, just they got going and not seen much happen, so they got discouraged.
Yeah.
But I think this is still just the beginning of something. I think we're still trying to plough up hard ground in many cases. And even if the virus has a bit of a, you know, respite from it, it may come back again when the next stage will happen. I think there's a lot more shaking up that will happen. But yes, it may seem like the smaller things at the moment, when they said that it looks like it's just not worth it at the moment. The place is too small. But we keep going. We trust that God is doing what he's doing. And I think people are, they're more open anyway. So any final comment? Otherwise, I think we might draw it to an end for tonight. Thank you very much. Oh, we've,
Dawn,
got one more.
We've got one hand. Dawn,
who's... Are you there, Dawn? Yeah?
Can you unmute yourself?
Yeah, that's it.
Sorry. Thank you for patience. So I was, I did some underlining as we were reading. So chapter 2, I noticed that God said it 3 times, take courage, take courage, take courage. And when Father God says things a lot, 3 times, that's a sign that,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that means he really, really does want us to take courage. So,
yeah.
Christine, and for everybody, it's he who fills us with courage, isn't it? And when he says, I will give you peace. And yeah. I guess, well, for myself, I've always... felt very dependent on God because of the way that I came to Christ and because of my personality and situation. But I think one of the key things that a lot of people might be learning during this situation is how to depend or how to really lean on God.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the things that I've experienced in the church, so I came to Christ independent of the church in Germany, in southern Germany, just randomly. Well, it wasn't randomly, but you know what I mean. And I found the church often ignores God. So I think what God's saying to us is, hello, I'm here. Thank you for listening.
Yes, Dawn, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. So next week, it will be a topic, I think, of some kind. I've got 2 or 3 topics lined up. And then, as I say, we're going to go back to a more yeshiva-type discussion on some of the more... Remember, we did weird stuff last time. It was here last time, last week. Mm-hmm. You did weird, didn't we? Okay, I've got lots more weird passages to look at. We might do a topic next week. So thank you for all your contributions. Thank you for coming along, and see you next time.
Thank you.